Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. I'm Guy McPherson. I'm looking forward to the return of my friend and colleague Mike Sleva next week. This edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. Sorry, but there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift for thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the next one, is provided by Rhiann Farrigan, a Scottish teenager. Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. I'll mention two stories. My first story goes beyond the echo chamber and comes from the keyboard of the dissident dad at Liberty Blitzkrieg on October 29th. It's a short article titled, I Pledge Allegiance. It's about requiring young students to pledge allegiance to the U.S. flag, and it includes these trenchant lines. Crazy when you think about it, right? Do we really want our obedience and loyalty to the U.S. federal government, especially when the pledge itself is masked with a lie? I mean, it ends with liberty and justice for all. Now, that's a crock of shit right there. Not one arrest in the financial sector for the 2008 crisis, not one investigation into the 2003 Iraq invasion where no WMDs were found, and a complete cover-up of the events of 9/11, i.e. Building 7. Liberty and justice for all. How about we ask Edward Snowden about that? His patriotic actions were described as treachery and disloyalty. My comment, George Orwell nailed it. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. My second story beyond the mainstream echoes the recent illegal arrest of whistleblower Ray McGovern, who I interviewed for this program 2 weeks ago. Posted by Simon Black at Sovereign Man on October 31st, it's titled, Warning, avoid this a corrupt third world country at all costs. It begins, quote, John Anderson, an American tourist from San Clemente, California, was driving down a poorly maintained highway when he saw flashing lights in his rearview mirror. After a brief exchange with the local police officer, Anderson was shocked when the cops started searching his vehicle. Anderson had $25,180 in U.S. dollar cash in the car, which, by the way, was not a crime according to the local laws. When the cops saw it, he told Anderson that we would take it and threatened him with arrest if he protested. Anderson couldn't believe it. This is the sort of stuff you always hear about in these third world countries, corrupt cops and state robbery. Ultimately, Anderson gave in. The cop let him go and did not charge him with a crime, but took every last penny in the vehicle. And for the last 2 years, Anderson has been trying to unsuccessfully fight it in the country's kangaroo court system. Clearly, we should all avoid going to such dangerously corrupt third world countries. Except in this case, Anderson was in the United States of America, and he is far from being the only victim of this highway robbery known as civil asset forfeiture. Since 9/11, police forces in the land of the free made over 62,000 seizures without charging anyone with crime, stealing $2.5 billion in cash alone. The cost of taking legal action against the government is so high that only about 17% of the victims actually challenged the seizures, and even then, only 41% of those that challenged have been able to get their money back. This means that the government has a better than 93% success rate in outright theft. End quote. Welcome to the land of the meek and the home of the crave. Repeat after me, fellow Americans. We're number one. As regular listeners know by now, we offer brief opinion pieces each week. In Breaking Hopium, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue. This week's contribution comes from a regular voice on this show. My colleague Forrest Palmer talks about our dependence upon rare earth metals to sustain industrial civilization.
Rare earth metals, a term infrequently discussed in the real world when it comes to supplying the global community with all the cell phones, hybrid cars, computers, flat screen televisions, and medical equipment forever. Of course, this is because people never think about scarcity of anything, as they believe that man's ingenuity will provide for a shortfall of any resource. The reason this is the case is because most people don't know, don't care, and think nothing about the particular chemical, mechanical, and electrical properties of the elements that they have in their electronics equipment. Well, regarding rare earth metals, which are the foundation of the electronics industry, let's take a look at where these metals are procured to illustrate how scarce they are in terms of their present availability. In recent times, more than 90% of rare earth metals are supplied from China. This is a monopoly if there ever was one. Although there are projects in the works to mine them in other areas across the globe, I would hazard to say that it will be a long time before this changes drastically, and more likely, not at all. If this isn't enough to give you a moment's pause as to the long-term availability of the latest and greatest electronic equipment, then let's look at some rare earth metals and how scarce they are from a natural standpoint. Although the name rare earth metals is really a misnomer, since most of them are presently in wide abundance in mining concentrations, the rare designation comes from the high degree of difficulty in extracting them from their sources. That being said, there are some that are truly rare. One example is tellurium, which makes up a scant 10 millionth percent of the Earth's crust, making it three times rarer than gold, yet is a necessity for thin, cheap solar panels. I don't think a green utopia of solar cell panels is in the offering with those type of numbers. Replacements might be your answer to all this, but it would mean there are ready substitutes for all of these various metals we are dependent upon for electronics. Well, in 2013, a Yale study was produced that detailed all the rare earth metals in a typical smartphone and asked the question if there were suitable substitutes for any of these 62 elements. According to this scientific analysis, not one metal has an exemplary substitute for any of its properties, and a dozen of the metals have inadequate substitutes or none at all. This doesn't bode well for the telecom industry and its desire to have every man, woman, and child on Earth with phones stuck to their ears. Recycling, you say, to salvage all of the metals used in our electronic equipment? Easier said than done. With world demand of rare earth metals reaching 136,000 tons per year, it was estimated that a scant 1% of these metals are recycled from e-waste. It doesn't take a mathematical genius to see that a 1% recycling rate is not a good sign of a cell phone 500 years from now having its entire parts list made of recycled material. So in short, all of the high-end electronic equipment will go the way of the dodo due to man's inability to face the fact we are reaching the bottom of the barrel for powering a Western lifestyle. My only suggestion would be to enjoy that cell phone. You never know when it might just be your last one.
This week, I engage in conversation with Dr. Carl Klein. Klein is Associate Professor of Computer Studies at Onondaga Community College in Syracuse, New York. I'll start with a little biographical information about the esteemed professor. Upon graduation from high school, Carl enlisted in the U.S. Navy. Initially trained as an electronics technician, he graduated from Naval Nuclear Power School in Orlando, Florida, following 49 months of service on the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier USS Nimitz. He was honorably discharged from military service after serving a total of 6 years in active duty. After military service, Carl graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Resource Management from Slippery Rock University in Pennsylvania. While attending Slippery Rock, he participated in a cooperative education program with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In that co-op program, he worked at several different core flood control and water resource projects in western Pennsylvania. He gained experience in law enforcement, information, resource management, and visitor services. After graduating from Slippery Rock, he was hired by the Corps of Engineers as a park ranger. After working as a park ranger for a couple of years, Carl attended East Stroudsburg University in Pennsylvania to obtain his Earth Science Teaching Certification. In addition, with his previous academic and work experience, his coursework in Earth Science qualified him for an additional certification in environmental education. After a brief experience teaching earth science and biology in rural Virginia, Carl took a job working in the Office of Environmental Health and Safety at the University of Virginia. In this position, he worked with chemicals, nuclear materials for research and medicine, and the disposal of nuclear and chemical waste products. After a few more years as a park ranger for the National Park Service, Carl attended graduate school at the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education, earning a Master of Education in Instructional Technology focused on the interaction of learners, teaching, and technology. Ultimately, Carl worked on his PhD degree in Educational Communications Technology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He's a member of the always popular ABD Club, that stands for All But Dissertation. 15 years ago, Carl accepted a position at the University of New York at Cortland in the Education Department, where he taught undergraduate and graduate courses for future teachers. He also helped create several student learning communities that use the SUNY Cortland outdoor education facilities at Camp Huntington at Raquette Lake in the Adirondack Mountain region of New York. During this time, he set up what was likely the first laptop computer wireless classroom in the entire SUNY system. In 2002, Carl began working at his current position in the Computer Studies Department at Onondaga Community College in Syracuse, New York. There, he teaches classes on basic computer operations, digital media, and the effects of technology on organizations. In addition, he supported his colleagues in using and integrating educational technology in the teaching and learning process. Demonstrating that teaching is a lifelong process, Carl began teaching a Sustainability 101 course in the spring of this year. Carl lives off-grid with his wife in Cortland County, New York. They garden extensively and are working to build up the nutrients in their mostly clay-based soil. They own a Toyota Prius, but are under no delusions that happy motoring will continue much longer. That's quite a diverse and extensive set of experiences, Carl. Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure to be here today with you.
Carl, we first met electronically. You were being featured in a film created by the National Inflation Association called College Conspiracy. You suggested the director contact me, and he brought a crew to the Mud Hut. We became two of the three talking heads in the film, joined by Gerald Valente. The film was viewed more than 3.5 million times before a complaint from a university caused it to be removed from YouTube. However, the film is still available on the web at topdocumentaryfilms.com and also can be found at my blog under the Films About Me tab. Why in the world did you send these filmmakers my way?
Well, you're one of the few academics that I really respect, and I think it's because of your ability to span the many silos that exist in higher education that I thought you might be an interesting person to talk with them about their project, which was to look at some of the things taking place in higher education today.
Let's talk about silos. You mentioned that they exist and that not many people can cross from one silo to another, appropriate way to state it. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, it probably ties back to the idea of the reason why I never did finish my PhD program, because as you well know, the idea of higher education is to study more and more and more about a smaller and smaller aspect of some academic discipline. And I think that with the problems facing the world for the last 30 or 40 years, that we have really suffered by this lack of focus on the big picture. I think that we need to have young people able to bridge across those traditional academic silos and be able to make connections and solve problems and see how things are connected.
Well, yeah, but all I ever hear from universities is exactly what they're doing, that faculty are encouraged to get outside their silos and do transdisciplinary research. Are you suggesting that that isn't happening?
Well, I'm only sitting here in my little small perch in upstate New York, and all I really see is that business as usual continues, and that we try to get people to, you know, climb the academic hierarchy by, you know, doing that focusing that I mentioned earlier. Unfortunately, while it wasn't so bad in the old days, one of the additional problems, and the College Conspiracy video covered this very well, I think, is the additional adding of the student debt racket to higher education. In order to proceed through that labyrinth now, it almost always means going into substantial levels of debt for young people.
Well, speaking of integration and getting outside our silos, integration of the natural sciences and the humanities has been a goal of various people throughout history, including, for example, Plato, C.P. Snow with his essay, Two Cultures, and more recently, Harvard conservation biologist Edward O. Wilson with his book, Consilience. So it sounds like that integration is not working at the institutions with which you're familiar. And I could comment at length about that, but I'd rather hear how integration of the natural sciences and the humanities in a very general sense has been promoted or is working out at your institution.
Well, before I do that, allow me to express this disclaimer. Any opinions expressed by me are mine alone and are likely not the opinions of the State University of New York, Onondaga Community College, or any of their administrators, staff, faculty, lackeys, minions, or affiliated enterprises. Thank you for letting me say that.
Excellent. Excellent. Well said.
Well, let me just illustrate your point by going to my campus here. Our campus spans a gorge that has a creek going down the middle of it. And traditionally, on one side of the gorge has been the humanities and social sciences, and across the gorge, on my side of the gorge, are the technology folks. So I think, architecturally, the building of our campus illustrates this traditional divide. And I agree that you're right that, things like NSF grants now try to encourage the inclusion of non-technical, disciplines in their grants, but I'm not sure it's working out that well.
Well, okay. Do you have any suggestions if you were college president or chancellor for a day, what kind of route would you pursue and how would you pursue it?
That's a really good question, Guy. I'm not sure what I would actually do. It's just so embedded in the culture that we just really have a hard time talking across that divide. At one point in my career, which involves a lot of technology, I was hoping that, the use of technology would allow us to begin to communicate across that divide. But I still see in the day-to-day operations of our campus and sometimes even the makeup of committees, there still is that inability to reach across that divide and trust the other people and see things from their perspective. And I think the problems that you have written about over the last few years of your career have clearly illustrated that we're not making much progress at that.
Yeah. I mean, I understand that administrators ultimately are motivated by money, that colleges and universities are pieces of a system that depends upon money and I think stresses that dependence entirely too frequently. So I understand that it's a tough battle for administrators given the financial motivation and also given the general lack of support for state universities from the states. Never has that been more evident than in the age of contraction that we're experiencing now with respect to the industrial economy.
Well, you've opened a whole bunch of topics there, I think. One thing I'd like to point out right now would be the fact that over the past 25, 30 years, there has been this tremendous growth in the number of administrators, and typically that comes at the expense of full-time faculty members. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, in olden times, it was not uncommon for faculty to step up temporarily into administrative-type jobs and take on those roles, with the idea being that when you return to the faculty, you would have to live with the results of your decisions as a temporary administrator. But in the last few years, the number of full-time so-called professional administrators has grown far beyond enrollment enrollment growth and faculty growth. And now it seems like there are many, many, many more people that faculty have to respond to as far as calls for data and new initiatives that don't amount to much in the classroom. So I think that's one of the problems. And I think now, as you mentioned, that, you know, since we're now past post-peak high school student, that this is the first time since probably World War II that the academy has had to deal with contraction. Up until now, it's always been bigger and bigger and better. And as you know, most of our systems, economic and otherwise, just are not built for contraction. And now we are faced with it. And it's challenging the entire structure.
Well, that's right. It challenges every structure with which we're familiar. As Edward Abbey pointed out many years ago, and I'm paraphrasing here, civilization, like an airplane, only stays aloft as it is moving forward. And economic contraction is underway, well hidden so far by governments, but it's underway nonetheless. And so what to do, how to deal with that from an administrative perspective, much less from the struggling faculty member and staff member who is being asked to do more with less all the time. Well, these are difficult challenges.
And unfortunately, well, now we have, you know, at least in New York, we have the original model back from the Rockefeller days was to have the public system, one-third, or the community college system, funded one-third by the state, one-third by the county typically, and one-third by the students. And over the last couple of years, we have shifted more and more and more of that burden onto the students. And that's mostly, or not mostly, it's largely funded by having students take on additional student loan debt, which there is no way it will ever all be repaid.
That's right. And that debt cannot be dealt with through personal bankruptcy either.
And that was a great, marvelous thing that the bankers pulled off several years ago when they changed the rules. So that is the only debt that cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. It was an amazing coup.
Yes, well, we're in the age of contraction. The banksters are getting increasingly bold with what they do, and I suspect increasingly desperate with the actions they take.
It was interesting to see that last week the Federal Reserve did finally say no more QE, but the very next day, I think it was, the Bank of Japan stepped up and said, "Oh, we'll keep going. Don't worry."
I would imagine, as has been reported in a few outlets within the last couple of months, that no QE means really QE in different forms. So, for example, Federal Reserve Bank has been printing money and either giving it or giving with interest-free loans to a whole host of countries. So that's hidden from view, but those are U.S. dollars still sloshing around the system. That's more debt for us, and no rewards in sight beyond sustaining the unsustainable system.
Right, and one of the things that's also developing right now that causes me great concern is all the developments in the area of robotics, which kind of comes back to my professional field. We are building robots to take even more jobs from workers in this country, which will enable them even be less able to pay back any student loan debts. So all the forces that are kind of converging right now, you know, may be unprecedented in the history of the world. And it's going to be hard to see how it works out well for people that have just assumed 4 and 5 figures of student loan debt with no job at the end because a robot has it.
Right. So robots don't require nearly as much vacation time or other so-called benefits as us regular people. You don't have to send them to the doctor when they get ill. You send them to the engineer instead.
Correct. And it's really, really worrisome given the fact that most of the so-called jobs from the so-called recovery have been in the service sector, which I think robots are poised to make great inroads in. And the techno-utopians are there cheering this on. irregardless of the impact on regular people and the social structure that we have. One of my other worries is that we have so many young people, and especially young men, with nothing to do right now. And this is just a recipe for a social disaster. How long will it go on? I have no idea.
Right. Well, we both know that it can't go on forever, that we can't sustain the unsustainable indefinitely, that at some point there are limits to our techno prowess. So we aren't going to have the robots, much less the robot bees that apparently are capable of pollinating food for much longer. So let's talk about the role of the academy, the role of higher education, and particularly let's focus on a couple of factors. Let's assume it's that we can't have infinite growth on a finite planet with no consequences. And in that world, the world that we were told would always be present, what's the role of the academy in dealing with evidence? It's a financial institution to a great extent. Every college and university now is monetized, is financialized. But there also, it seems to me, should be a role in dealing with evidence. Can you comment on that? And it can be evidence on any topic. You pick it.
Okay. Well, let me think about that for a second. I think that, you know, it is one of the few remaining institutions that people still do have some trust in. So I think there still is an important role for the academy to play going forward, regardless of, you know, all those external factors. One thing I can think of is I was listening to an old podcast or an old presentation by Dmitry Orlov that he did for the Long Now Foundation, and he talked about how it would be a great thing for colleges to repurpose themselves as places where people can go and learn to farm and have gardens and see how life really, really works in the real world. So there's that possibility going forward that we have these places that have lots of housing for people that would be quite efficient, dorm-story housing. That's there. That could be a possibility in the future. I know a lot of schools, you know, are working down that way. That's the purpose of my sustainability class, is to have people start to think about those sorts of issues. So I think I got sidetracked there, Guy.
No, that's all right. Assuming we have infinite growth on a finite planet with no consequences, it's an ideal world for academia. And so there are no issues with money. It's no longer a money-making proposition. Instead, it returns to – the institutions are able to return to whatever it is they should be doing best. So what is it they should be doing best? What's the role of evidence in academic institutions?
Well, I think it used to be that was what they were kind of based around, was growing the body of knowledge. And I think one thing that's happened in the last several years has been, as you noted, the monetization of the enterprise. In that, I mean, even using the word enterprise kind of changes what it used to be. Back in the days when land-grant institutions were set up, they were sort of set up to help people learn to become better farmers. But now, unfortunately, I think in many cases, the land-grant institutions are now beholden to the big money that comes from places like Cargill, Monsanto, Syngenta, DuPont, and all the rest of the names that are familiar to people that know about GMOs. So I think that process has been corrupted, and that the data is paid for by those institutions, and now that they have bought the data they need to get things like GMOs approved, we do risk having people lose faith in our institutions in that sense, at least. And I think I would probably want to fault that, going back to our silo concept for a moment, I think that we have sort of let a lot of the scientific types, techno types, run amok without being called to account by our friends in the social science and humanities. That bridge has, or that divide has worked against us in that sense. I think there still is quite a bit of trust. I think there still are people that in all good, in their hearts are trying to do good science and good research. but I'm not sure that that's going to actually go on much longer, given the fact that everything has now become monetized.
Right. I mean, all that aside, everybody I talk to, every academic I talk to, says they will never be corrupted, that money is of little interest to them, that they're just putting together the evidence in as objective a manner as could be possible, for given that we're human beings.
Well, that brings to mind the old Upton Sinclair quote once again of, it's hard to get a man to understand something when his paycheck depends upon him not understanding it. And when I see how much it costs to outfit a lab and the overhead charges that are at a Research One school like a Stanford or a Penn State or a Cornell, that it's hard to really believe that people that need to write that $1 million grant are going to actually be able to be as honest as they claim. Probably in their own minds they are, but I'm not sure that the results justify that.
Yes. Yes, in our minds we're pretty amazing individuals. In other people's minds, maybe not so much. Now, that brings us to another point. In prior conversations, we've discussed the timidity of people paid to think. So academics, for example, and tenured academics are actually paid to think. And those, it seems like a lot of those people are quite timid in the statement that they make. Can you comment on that from your personal experience?
Yeah, that's been a big frustration of mine. I where I work, we do teach more classes than you would teach at a Cornell or Syracuse University, because we're a community college, but we still do have the privilege and the pleasure of having time to do research and think and be able to, you know, hopefully put together big ideas and concepts for our students. But as has been a common theme on some of the Facebook groups that we're part of, most people that I talk to where I work and in this vicinity in central New York, there's very few people that are actually aware of things like near-term human extinction. And it just frustrates me no end that people that have time to connect the dots either can't do it or won't do it or are afraid to do it, perhaps even. I'm not even sure about that. But it's a very lonely vigil to be thinking about the things that you write about and are part of, because there is just so few people that have the privilege of the time to look into these issues and then just can't do much about it. This last IPCC summary that came out yesterday is a good example of that, in that once again, academic types have stopped short of lighting their hair on fire and say, we still have, I think it said like 65 years still to go before bad things really, really happen. And it's just hard to believe that the high-level people that contribute to the IPCC reports just can't come out and say with more vigor that it's really, 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 really bad.
Well, yeah, there's no mention of methane. There's apparently no comprehension of methane in the IPCC. Part of that stems from the process. It's a process that operates by consensus. And so if there's one person in the working group who is unwilling to let methane into the conversation, then methane doesn't make it into the conversation. Then after it passes through this incredibly conservative process, then it has to be vetted politically. So it's difficult to rely on the IPCC for anything resembling cutting edge.
Yeah, I was scanning the report last night in preparation for this, and I kept hoping to see some mention of methane. I didn't expect to see clathrate gun mentioned, because that would just be too scary, but I was hoping to see the first hints of that making it into that report, but alas, I was disappointed.
Yes. This is Guy McPherson on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm joined today by Professor and Homesteader Carl Klein from Onondaga Community College in upstate New York. Now, speaking of near-term human extinction, I know you struggle as do I, with how much to say to young people with whom you interact. What is the moral responsibility to at least raise the possibility of near-term human extinction with students? Do young people deserve to be told this information, or what's your take on that?
Well, it's one that I wrestle with nearly every day, especially in my sustainability class. It's not so hard in my computer classes because it's kind of outside the realm of the curriculum there, although I do have what I call Sustainability Week, where I do broach the topics. And in the past, I have had a number of students in my computer classes come up later, and we begin to have a conversation. I guess it kind of falls down on, you know, what do you think the purpose of higher education is, and should we bridge those silos that actually tell young people what we perceive to be the truth about the future they're facing? So I do tend to sort of sidle up to the topic kind of, you know, slowly and see if there's interest in my classes. But I do think that we do have a responsibility as academics to give people our positions about what we think is coming down the road for them. I know if I was sitting there as an 18, 20-year-old young person, I would want to know what my professors thought about what the future was going to hold for me so I could make reasonable plans. I'm not sure that's actually true today for young people, but I still do my best to sort of let them know where I'm coming from and begin to broach those topics. It's a great thing to have. One of my classes is late at nighttime, so sometimes students will stay after class, and we can go down this road a little more than I would like to do for the whole class. So that's the great part about the conversations that occur, you know, offline outside of classes. I do think that all the electronic devices that students have today sort of discourage that human contact where these conversations can take place. One of my saddest things I see is going down the hall on the way to class, I'll see students standing in the hallway with other people immersed in their devices. There's human beings right there, and they're so immersed in their electronic devices that they can't enjoy the people that they're with.
Yeah, that's tough, and it's symptomatic of this relatively gradual shift away from interpersonal interactions and towards interpersonal interactions conducted at a distance through an electronic medium. It's difficult to fault the students because they've been told their whole lives that they're the most connected generation ever and that it's a good thing. So I'm not sure what to do about that. I got a smartphone only a couple of months ago as a gift, and before that, I had been telling people to get off their smartphones. Now, I send people text messages telling them to stop sending text messages because it's consuming all their time.
One of my regrets is in the past, I have been sort of a techno advocate. And now, at the time, I was kind of hoping that people would use it for good and for appropriate uses. But I think we have now gone overboard. Although I do take some solace in the idea that I kind of compare the smartphone mania with the CB radio craze of my youth, and that at one point in time, in the mid-70s or so, there were CB radios everywhere. They were in the media, there were songs about them, and they're still here, and truck drivers still use them, but they have really diminished in use. So I keep hoping that at some point in time, we'll see the pendulum begin to swing back and that people will come to value human interaction more than electronically mediated things, and they'll be more put into a box and used when appropriate. But I could be dreaming.
Well, it's tough, too. For the most part, these are one-way streets. Technology is basically a one-way street. I mean, it's difficult for me to imagine, even myself at this point, going back to a black phone that you actually have to dial, that you're making sparks. That's a level of technology there. And you know, it's been a long time since that happened, but we both remember it. In a single human generation, we've experienced all these incredible technological advances without really thinking about the costs.
Well, this is where I kind of think back and know that and acknowledge that there are still people that buy vinyl records. So they still take great pleasure in it. They have a good case that it's still a warmer and better sound than digital quality things. So, you know, there's still maybe some hope that there will still be a chance to go back and value human relations again and get away from some of the mediated things that were now just, it's just killing us.
Yes, yes, indeed. Speaking of technology, I wouldn't normally ask this question, but you sent it to me as a possible question to ask you, so you asked for it, so I'm going to pitch it at you. Why have you not taken more steps to walk away from Empire as a certain other teacher has?
Well, that is a great question. I've been thinking about it since I sent you that question earlier last week.
It must be a great question. You offered it up, so I'm blaming you for this one.
That's true. I'm responsible. I'll take responsibility for it. Well, in our conversations, I have heard you say that sometimes you have regretted what you've done there. So that takes away some of the motivation that I might have to just say the heck with it and walk away. Although I have to concede that nearly every day the thought does cross my mind about why am I still doing what I'm doing, knowing what I know and what I think is going to happen. So it's a I don't think I have an answer, and as we both know, sometimes, you know, there are no solutions to problems, and this is just a dilemma that I'm wrestling with. I do have the thought that, you know, as soon as I can, I'm going to just stay here at our place and ride my tractor and just drink beer all day long and just enjoy what's left. So I am looking forward to that time. I have to convince the wife that I can walk away, which is probably one of the options that's keeping me still going to work.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. Right. With your first few words, you did point out that I have regrets, that in fact, I regret every day. I've come to view my leaving the university, the job I loved for which I was getting paid a lot of money to do essentially no work. That was a terrible mistake. And so, I would, if you enjoy what you're doing, then I would certainly encourage you to keep doing it. Not just you, but anybody who is in a position that they actually enjoy. I certainly wouldn't recommend following my lead on this one.
Well, as you know from teaching, there are those moments in teaching when things go really, really well, and it is the most incredible high that you can experience. When a student comes up to you afterwards and you have a conversation for the next 2 hours about something, or you connect with some students and you present an idea they never thought of before, and they let you know that, or years later, a student will all of a sudden, an email will pop up or a phone call comes, and a student says, I really, really liked your class back there, and, you know, pick a date. Those moments are worth more than money. And I think, you know, both you and I are motivated by more than money at most times, hence you're walking away and why I do enjoy those moments. Unfortunately, I think those moments may be becoming more and more scarce as students fall into the trap of thinking that higher education is just about job training and not so much about becoming a good human being. And I think that's, again, where I would fault some of my colleagues in the humanities and social sciences, in that they have not been successful at communicating to students what the purposes of those general education electives are, to figure out how to be a good citizen, how to be a good human being, how to be a good person. We are losing that, I think. And I think that begins, you know, going back to the elementary school level now, where even those teachers are now forced into teaching to a test, and there's bubble forms, and if you don't take the test, this happens, and parents are forced into sending their kids in for tests, and the kids are crying during tests. Every kid takes a test, including special education kids. It's the whole system is really just becoming more and more destructive to human beings, and I think one reason I haven't walked away is because because of tenure, I can afford to sort of push back against some of these forces, but I think it may be a losing battle. I'm not sure.
Well, it certainly is a tough battle. It's one that must be joined, that you must participate in, because you don't have any choice, and because there are so few currently promoting the idea of consilience, of reaching across disciplinary boundaries and pursuing lives of meaning instead of lives motivated by money. So along similar lines, can you comment on the notion of going dark and using the collapse of civilization as a touchstone for your classes? Or maybe it comes up. Does it come up
Well, it comes up in a I try to bring it up in sort of a humorous, just kidding kind of way. It's pretty easy to point out many of the follies of today's civilization. In one of my classes, I've been using a lot of the Chris Martins in Crash Course videos, where Chris, who is very data-driven, has the charts and the numbers that sort of show things. And, of course, every chart he has pretty much is an exponential, logarithmic, to the moon, Alice and back kind of chart. So we do have the opportunity to show things that certainly are still going on but can't go on forever and let students draw their own conclusions. So I think, you know, in the course of a semester of seeing things like the crash course, that students will have to come to the conclusion that this can't go on. So the question will become, what takes its place? Well, I was listening to a podcast interview with David Graeber over the weekend, and he's talking about things like debt jubilees. And when I raise that issue with my students, they're all in great favor of something like that.
Yes, of course, because they have the debt.
But it's hard to see how that could actually work out given, you know, the experience that I've had in life, and that I just don't see the bankers and the financial system letting go of what it has right now. But, you know, I do know in my head that it just can't go on forever. So something's going to happen. And David Graeber in his podcast interview was saying that he thinks maybe 10 more years. But whenever I hear time prognostications, I think of the wisdom of Dmitry Orlov, where he says, anytime you hear that, think plus and minus half a decade for any kind of, prophecy. So we'll see what happens.
Right. And even there are a few factors indicating that the system may not hold another 10 years. For example, all of the shortfall in the world of crude plus condensate has been made up U.S. tight oil. And according to the Texas Railroad Commission report from August, it looks like that might be game over, that it apparently has peaked as of August and is headed down quite significantly. In addition, Orlov himself, who lived in the Boston Harbor for I don't even know how long, 15 years, 20 years, left a couple of months ago because a few months before that, he said in response to the question, how long does American Empire have left? For the first time, he said, it's going to be over soon. So there are a couple of pieces of evidence indicating that sustaining the unsustainable can't be done through smoke and mirrors.
I would also add Richard Heinberg's work lately about, you know, actually going into her and buying the data from the producers and looking at individual well production and looking at that across the country and saying it is nothing but a Ponzi scheme. And that's what we saw here in New York, and that 5-6 years ago, Chesapeake et al. Came in, started buying up massive, massive bits of property, and they have just flipped them to Statoil and other places around the world, and the leases are now being let go. So there's no way these energy companies would ever let these leases expire unless it was pretty close to being game over for that energy production. But that's where I think we really do our students a disservice, too, in that, yeah, as you wrote years ago, your first hope had been that peak oil would sort of let this system know that it couldn't go on forever. But now we've gotten all this fracking and other things that you just mentioned going on that make it sound like the system can go on for at least, 30 or 40 more years. And I just don't think that's going to happen. And I think our students are going to be in for a really, really, really rough time when they finally do realize that the jig is up.
Yes, it's not just the students who are going to be whacked up the side of the head with that one.
I would go back to what Orlov said about when the Soviet Union collapsed, the most tiresome people were the middle-aged white people because they just couldn't cope with the changes that had come.
That's right. Yes. And that was a system much better programmed or developed or designed or adapted, if you will, for collapse, with three generations in households and no personally owned homes, so therefore no mortgages, no banksters to come in and take your house away.
And the trains kept running and this building stayed heated and they had built robust electrical systems. So, the basics of life were still provided. So that's what Orlov talks about and compares, the resilience of the Soviet system versus the efficiency of our system. And we are hyper-efficient, which, again, once once the trucks stop bringing food to the local grocery store, it's going to be a rough time.
Yes, I think that would certainly qualify as the understatement of the week. There's more too. I mean, you mentioned the Ponzi scheme that is fracking. But apparently all the tight oil at this point represents a Ponzi scheme. It's a debt-based system that is geared toward getting energy, but not really making people any money in doing so. So that, again, that just can't go on indefinitely.
Melissa, where the work of an ESF, environmental science and forestry professor, Charlie Hall, comes into play, where he talks about energy return on energy invested, which is a real-world principle that Charlie spent in a career talking about and getting people's attention. But because of the financialization of things, it looks like these things make money, but they really, really don't. I'm from Pennsylvania, and there's an article this morning I was reading talking about how the energy companies are stiffing the lease owners in Pennsylvania because they add all kinds of charges before they pay any royalties to people. So the poor people in Pennsylvania have given away clean air, clean water, noise, and all those kind of things for the promise of a paycheck, when it's just it's a racket where they just take out all the expenses before they pay them a check. And many people now, because the price collapse of natural gas, are not getting even anything right now. And they've got the pipelines and the compressor stations and the polluted water and the truck traffic all in place now, and they've got nothing to show for it in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so really it could be game over for the industrial economy in the United States anyway. Just about any time. Even Dmitry Orlov ultimately gave up on his five stages of collapse. Now there are two, and one of them ended in 2008, 2009. So we're one step away from, based on his original five-part system.
And I think you can see the cultural collapse happening. You know, it's not evenly distributed yet, but you can see things happening across the country. You know, Ferguson, Missouri is one example of that, where things just kind of fell apart, and it's not being put back together very, very well.
That's right. That's right. And we see the inability of government to deal with what used to be relatively small problems, and now they have become huge predicaments. And there's several of them every day, it seems. So, yes. Things are decaying and could well end in a heap quite suddenly.
One of my friends here points out over and over and over again that one of the small towns near here is called Homer, New York, and my friend tells me that every day Homer looks the same as yesterday, so Carl is not here yet.
Yes, Francis Bacon's Idyll of the Den. It hasn't happened yet, therefore it will never happen.
The system can hold on a lot longer than I can probably hold out too. So, again, predictions are rough, but it sure feels like we're on the cusp of something right now.
Yes, it feels that way to me too. Okay, Carl, that's all the time we have. I very much appreciate you joining us on Nature Bats Last today.
It's my pleasure, Guy. Thank you for having me.
Have a great day.
You too.
This week's climate change update includes the following few items. Item 1. How hopeless is the situation with respect to climate change? On Monday, the 27th of October, the chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said, on the brink of releasing the synthesis report from the IPCC's vaunted GES assessment, quote, "It's not hopeless." Yes, that's the most optimistic statement possible from the most conservative scientific institution on the planet. It's not hopeless. That, of course, means it is hopeless. Item 2. 2 days later, Jason Box writes at darksnow.org, quote, "Photos and video I took during an August 2014 South Greenland maintenance tour of promise.org climate stations and an extreme ice survey time-lapse camera went viral, featuring a surprisingly, to me and others, dark surface of Greenland ice," end quote. This is the order of the day every day for mainstream climate scientists, but I doubt anybody paying attention to the big picture can legitimately claim to be surprised by dark snow in Greenland. Item 3. That same day, October 29th, Robert Scribler reports with this headline, "Ominous Arctic methane spikes continue, 2,666 parts per billion on October 26th. His bottom line, several decades late, quote, what is clear is that feedback to the human heat forcing are now starting to become plainly visible, that they are providing evidence of a stronger release from some sources on a yearly basis, a troubling amplifying feedback to the already dangerous and extraordinary human emission, one that should serve both as a warning and as a spur to reduce and eliminate human greenhouse gas emissions from all sources and to switch energy systems away from fossil fuels as swiftly as possible, end quote. Right. We'll no doubt get right on that because the science is clear. Oh, wait. It's been clear for more than a century, and we haven't done squat. I won't be holding my breath on that one. Item 4. The following day, October 30th, Scribbler's report is titled, quote, late October sees strong polar amplification, mangled jet stream impacting much of Antarctica, end quote. He writes, quote, a couple of days ago, hourly CO2 levels rocketed from 396 parts per million to 399.5 parts per million, a rather odd and somewhat ominous jump back toward the 400 parts per million level at a time of year when atmospheric CO2 should be just starting a slow rebound from lowest ebb, a bottom that this year hit about 395 parts per million during mid-September, a measure already more than 2.2 parts per million above last year's low. To say the least, an hourly upward swing of 3.5 parts per million isn't exactly normal, especially when one considers the fact that the world hasn't seen near 400 parts per million CO2 levels for about 3 million years. This year peaked near 403 parts per million during late spring. And all that extra CO2, when combined with other greenhouse gases, is having an increasingly obvious impact on climate. We see it in the record global average temperatures. We see it in the rising oceans, which have come more and more to threaten the cities, lands, and isles upon which so many of us reside. We see it in increasing instances of extreme weather around the globe, in the extraordinary and often persistent droughts, floods, storms, and wildfires, and we see it in the form of a rather strong temperature amplification at both poles, end quote. Item 5, a new study just out of the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society echoes the long-known point that the IPCC is far too conservative. In scientific parlance, the paper concludes that the IPCC is focused on avoiding what are called type 1 errors, claiming something is happening when it really is not, or a false positive, rather than on avoiding type 2 errors, not claiming something is happening when it really is, a false negative. One consequence, according to an October 30th story in the Washington Post, quote, is that we do not always hear directly from the IPCC about how bad things can be, end quote. My response, as you might expect, to expand a bit. Duh, really? The IPCC operates by consensus and then clears its results through the political process. By the time they're done, any conclusions have been watered down to the point of irrelevance. People accuse me of being an extremist when I don't adhere to the IPCC's assessments, which carry about as much weight as the final reports of the Warren Commission or the 9/11 Commission. You can find all the latest updates on the climate change front at climatecurtain.com. Each week we seek a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo, but also provides insightful and useful information. Our doomer for this week is Rob Lynn Crawford, who responds to this post on Facebook, written by Christy Lewis. The quote from Christy Lewis is, I was at a big seminar today. Lots of important big shot arsehole idiots. I tried to communicate the science between NTHE and Arctic methane release. They wouldn't listen. They terminated my talk early, saying I had no peer-reviewed literature. Well, duh. That's what I'm proposing with research. Maybe I should just walk away from this field and enjoy what's left of my life without these battles that defeat me. In response, Rob Lynn Crawford writes, Mother Nature has the last fuck you. Don't you worry. You are there to help them, and if they are not willing to accept your help and insight, then merely pity them. Don't let it hurt your self-confidence. I'm doing research on aspects of near-term human extinction, but I'm calling it something else, irreversible climate change. Good for you. Thanks for the comment, Roblin. That about wraps it up for the week. Please tune in next week as I'm joined by Mike Sliva. Be sure to like our Facebook page, NatureBats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions if you'd like us to address on the show. And please continue to follow my blog, GavinCurtain.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. Beginning in 10 days, I'll be hosted by Peter Melton in and around Chico, California for a week. You can keep abreast of that and future speaking tours on my blog and also on Facebook. I'll finalize my trip to California by participating in the Earth at Risk conference in San Francisco on the weekend of November 22nd and 23rd. I'll be there with an impressive slate of speakers, including Derek Jensen, Chris Hedges, Vandana Shiva, Richard Manning, and many more. I'm not sure how I sneaked by the selection committee, but I'm honored to be included. If you're finding yourself in need of support in dealing with these admittedly heavy issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group page on Facebook and join the conversation. There are plenty of people going through a similar emotional roller coaster who help provide some personal insight into these issues. Last Thursday night in that group, Paul Ruffel had this to say, quote, "Lately I've been noticing a frightening trend going on inside my head. I thought it keeps popping up. Hey, what if scientific evidence and all those doomers are wrong? Then Mr. Reality checks back in and says, hey, dumbass, what if they're right? Holy hopium, does it never end? I would like to know if anybody else is struggling with this kind of feeling. I try to mentally reward myself, trying to prepare emotionally. But every day is a new day, a new experience of NTHE. Several people posted supportive comments as I've come to expect from the group. I'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening. If you missed the show, be sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to Afrazen and Rianne Ferrigan for the music.
Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. She's gonna get